Chapter 41. The first leg of the trip was simple, a walk down a forest trail next to a backward flowing river until we reached a menhir. That's a large, upright standing stone to those of you without a pressing need to find out what a menhir is. I found where a pentangle had been inscribed on the stone, a five-pointed star within a circle, like the one around my neck. It had been done with a small chisel of some kind and was a little lopsided. My mother had put it there to mark which side of the stone to open the way on. I ran my fingers over it for a moment. As much as my necklace or the gem that now adorned it, it was tangible proof of her presence. She had been real, even if I had no personal memories of her, and that innocuous little marking was further proof. "My mother made this mark," I said quietly. I didn't look back at Thomas, but I could all but feel the sudden intensity of his interest. He had a few more memories than I did, but not many, and it was possible that he had me outclassed in the parental figure issues department, too. I opened another way, and we came through into a dry gulch with a stone wall next to a deep channel in the stone that might have once held a river. Now it was full of sand. It was dark, chilly, and the sky was full of stars. "Okay," I said, "now we walk." I summoned a light and took the lead. Martin scanned the skies above us. The constellations. Where are we?" I clambered up a stiff little slope that was all hard stone and loose sand and looked out over the vast expanse of silver white beneath the moon. Great shapes loomed up from the sand, their sides almost serrated in the clear moonlight. Lines and right angles that clashed sharply with the ocean of sand and flatland around them. "Giza," I said. "You can't see the Sphinx from this side, but I never claimed to be a tour guide. Come on." It was a stiff 2 or 3 miles from the hidden gully to the pyramids, and sand all the way. I took the lead, moving in a shambling, loose-kneed jog. There wasn't any worry about heat. Dawn was underway, and in an hour the place would be like one giant cookie pan in an oven. But we'd be gone by then. My mother's amulet led me directly to the base of the smallest and most crumbly pyramid, and I had to climb up 3 levels to reach the next waypoint. I stopped to caution the party that we were about to move into some place hot and to shield their eyes. Then I opened the way and we continued through. We emerged onto a plain beside enormous pyramids, but instead of being made of stone, these were all formed of crystal, smooth and perfect. A sun that was impossibly huge hung in the sky directly overhead, and the light was painfully bright, rebounding up from the crystal plane to be focused through the pyramids and refracted over and over and over again. "Stay out of those sunbeams," I said, waving in the direction of several beams of light so brilliant that they made the Death Star lasers look like they needed to hit the gym. "They're hot enough to melt metal." I led the group forward around the base of one pyramid, into a slim corridor of, well, it wasn't shade, but there wasn't quite so much light there, until we reached the next waypoint, where a chunk the size of a large man's fist was missing from one of the perfectly smooth edges of the pyramid. Then I turned 90 degrees to the right and started walking. I counted 500 paces. I felt the light, not heat, just the sheer, overwhelming amount of light, beginning to tan my skin. Then we came to an aberration, a single lump of rock upon the crystalline plain. There were broad, ugly facial features on the rock, primitive and simple. "Here," I said, and my voice echoed weirdly, though there was seemingly nothing from which it could echo. I opened another way, and we stepped from the plain of light and into chilly mist and thin mountain air. A cold wind pushed at us. We stood in an ancient stone courtyard of some kind. Walls stood around us, broken in many places, and there was no roof overhead. Murphy stared up at the sky where stars were faintly visible through the mist and shook her head. "Where now?" "Machu Picchu," I said. "Anyone bring water?" "I did," Murphy said, "and at the same time as Martin, Sonia, Molly, and Thomas." "Well," Thomas said, while I felt stupid, "I'm not sharing." Sonia snorted and tossed me his canteen. I sneered at Thomas and drank, then tossed it back. Martin passed Susan his canteen, then took it back when she was finished. I started trudging. It isn't far from one side of Machu Picchu to the other, but the walk is all uphill, and that means a hell of a lot more in the Andes than it does in Chicago. All right, I said, stopping beside a large mound built of many rising tiers that, if one squinted up his eyes enough, looked a lot like a ziggurat-style pyramid, or maybe an absurdly large and complicated wedding cake. When I open the next way, we'll be underwater. We have to swim 10 feet in the dark. Then I open the next way, and we're in Mexico. I was doubly cursing the time we'd lost in the Earl King's realm. Did anyone bring any climbing rope? Sonia, Murphy, Martin, look, you get the picture. There were a lot of people standing around who were more prepared than me. They didn't have super-duper fairy godmother presents, but they had brains, and it was a sobering reminder to me of which was more important. We got finished running a line from the front of the group to the back, except for my godmother, who sniffed disdainfully at the notion of being tied to a bunch of mortals, and I took several deep breaths and opened the next way. Mom's notes on the next waypoint hadn't mentioned that the water was cold. And I don't mean cold like your roommate used most of the hot water. I mean cold like I suddenly had to wonder if I was going to trip over a seal or a penguin or a narwhal or something.